Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're jumping into something really fascinating. The actual minutes from the Council of Chalcedon in 451 AD.
Right, and this isn't just, dry history. We're looking at it almost like a forensic analysis.
Exactly, like a historical cold case. We want to look past the official story and see how this incredibly important council actually worked on the ground.
And the source material itself, the minutes, they throw up what this analysis calls forensic flags. Think of them as clues, procedural weirdness, things that don't quite add up.
Clues that suggest maybe things weren't quite as straightforward theologically as we might think.
Precisely. They point towards, well, a lot of political and personal agendas really twisting the proceedings, influencing what became core Christian doctrine.
Okay, so where does this investigation, this cold case, really start? What's the first big piece of evidence?
It kicks off right away, Session I. With the treatment of Dioscorus of Alexandria. He was, the main figure of controversy going in.
And how is he treated?
Well, the bias seems pretty clear from the get-go. Pope Leo's representative basically announced, "We have instructions. Dioscorus shouldn't take a seat at the assembly."
So, excluded from the start.
Effectively, yeah. He was forced to sit in the center, like someone already accused, not as an equal participant.
That certainly sets a tone.
It does. And later, Session III, they hold his trial in absentia. He protested, said he was literally under guard, couldn't attend.
So he couldn't even defend himself properly.
Apparently not. And the charges themselves were often kept kind of vague until the verdict was practically decided. Plus, some accusers clearly had personal beef with him. It really undermines the idea of, fair process.
It sounds less like a council and more like a... Well, something else. What about the general vibe in these sessions? Was it calm, scholarly debate?
Oh, not at all. The minutes paint a picture of, frankly, chaos. Lots of emotional manipulation, even mob pressure.
Really? Like shouting?
Absolutely. Session I was full of it. You had bishops yelling contradictory things, "Drive out Theodoret," and then others shouting, "Drive out Dioscorus, the murderer."
Wow.
Yeah, and some bishops even claimed they'd signed documents at the previous council, Ephesus, basically under duress because of force with blows.
Physical threats.
That's what they claimed. It got so bad that the imperial officials present actually had to step in and say, "Look, these vulgar outbursts are not becoming to bishops."
So not exactly a serene theological gathering.
Hardly. It suggests that decisions could be heavily swayed by, well, who could shout the loudest or intimidate the most.
Okay, so that leads to another flag you mentioned, prescripted outcomes, and the emperor getting involved.
Definitely. The imperial hand seems quite heavy. In session two, the officials straight up demanded a new definition of faith.
Even if the bishops didn't want one.
Right. The text says there was apparently unanimous opposition from the bishops initially. They felt the existing Nicene Creed was sufficient.
But the emperor insisted.
The pressure ramped up. By session V, the emperor basically threatened them to produce an unambiguous definition, or he'd move the whole council to the west, away from their power base.
That's serious pressure.
It worked. The final Chalcedonian definition ended up being drafted by a small sort of elite group. And interestingly, no records were kept of their debates.
So the actual key discussion was off the books.
Seems like it. Even the initial draft text they worked from, it was suppressed, not included in the official minutes we have. It raises huge questions about how much was theological consensus versus, just meeting an imperial deadline.
That's a critical point. The analysis also talks about bringing back figures who'd been previously condemned, sort of rewriting history.
Yeah, that's another pattern. For political reasons, it seems. Look at Theodoret of Cyrus and Ibas of Edessa.
They had controversial views, right? Nestorian leanings.
Exactly. Views that had been condemned before. But here, in sessions 8 and X, they're brought back into the fold, often after making a kind of forced public condemnation of Nestorius.
So a public recantation gets them back in.
Pretty much. And crucially, the Second Council of Ephesus, the one Dioscorus had presided over, was just annulled in session X.
Annulled how? Did they review it carefully?
Get this. Without a full reading of its minutes. It's incredibly convenient if you want to discredit Dioscorus and, frankly, avoid embarrassing a lot of the bishops who were at Chalcedon who had also supported Ephesus II earlier.
So just erase the bits of history that don't fit the current narrative.
It certainly looks that way. It shows how fluid history can be when power dynamics shift.
And the final example really seems to drive this home, Canon 28. This sounds purely political.
It's perhaps the clearest case of politics trumping theology in the minutes. This Canon 28 massively boosted the status and privileges of Constantinople.
Okay, but how was it passed?
Well, the analysis points out it was adopted at an informal meeting the day before, crucially in the absence of the Roman delegates and even the imperial officials.
So done quietly, without key players present.
Exactly. When the Roman delegates found out, they immediately lodged a formal objection. They saw it as undermining Rome's traditional authority.
Did their objection matter?
Ultimately, no. The canon was confirmed by imperial decree. The emperor wanted his capital city, Constantinople, to have ecclesiastical clout matching its political power. Canonical tradition or Roman objections didn't stop it.
So, looking back at all these flags, the marginalization, the pressure, the imperial meddling, the historical revisionism, the raw politics, what's the takeaway for you listening now?
Well, I think this deep dive shows pretty consistent patterns, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You see outcomes seemingly decided in advance. You see due process just eroded when it's inconvenient.
And politics constantly influencing what are presented as purely theological decisions.
Right. Bianskus' story is a stark example of how power shapes the narrative. How someone can be condemned, perhaps not just for theology, but for being on the wrong side of the political equation.
So the question it leaves you with is pretty profound. How should you critically approach even these foundational historical events? What does Chalcedon teach us about that constant, complex dance between power, politics, and the search for truth?